So knowing we were going to each have a topic to discuss, I thought the easy thing to do would be to talk about Berkshire Hathaway. And I thought, no, I talk about Berkshire too much. And so starting to go through quarterly earnings, and doing some work last night on some of the businesses that we own. I kind of have I've had this growing sense, this growing unease, if you will, over the last couple months, really in watching some of these kind of these new tech businesses go absolutely straight up in the middle of a pandemic. We don't know what the backside of this recovery is going to look like. And really, for the first time, I think I'm starting to see a lot of parallels between what's going on now and some of the things that I saw and really the way that I felt in early 2000, leading up to the peak on March 10 of 2000, when the NASDAQ bubble peaked and S&P, shortly thereafter, I think on the 24th of that month. So, last night I ran a screen and I thought, let's look at this tech stuff. And I ran simply the number of US headquartered companies that are trading at more than 10 times revenues that also have market caps of over $1 billion and came up with several hundred companies. And at the top of that list, you've got, all the classics, certainly the five big tech companies that now make up 25% of the value of the S&P 500. But you've got a number of businesses, that are trading at very, very large market caps, relative to revenues. And if you go back and I ran that same screen last night, and I actually pulled the March 10, 2000 list of companies trading at over 10 times sales. And it was the darlings of the NASDAQ at the time. It was Microsoft, which I've written about, and how the experience, for the 15 years after the stock peaked on January 1, 2000, which I had written about in my January 1, 2000 client letter, and really predicted that shareholders would lose money for the next 15 years. Microsoft traded at a $620 billion market cap on $20 billion in sales, so 31 to sales, but Cisco traded at 33 times. Intel traded at 14 times, and I'm talking multiples to sales, not earnings. Oracle traded at 25 times. And if you go through the list of the subsequent experience, had you bought those stocks at the peak, it wasn't great. Intel compounded since then at 2.3%, Oracle at 2.3%, Sun Microsystems declined by 95%, was acquired by Oracle. The combined market cap of those two businesses, rolled up inside each other, is now less than the market cap of either one from 20 years ago. Texas Instruments is compounded at 3.5%. So, it really wasn't a great outcome. Microsoft, which was negative for 15 years on a total return basis, has now compounded at about 8% a year. And, that's on this enormous growth in their cloud business. The stock traded at, like I said, 31 times sales, but 80 times earnings. Declined actually, the profit margin got just slid from 38% down to 22% at the low, and it's back up to 30%. And the stock's trading today at, north of, 40 times earnings again. It's very high valuation. It's trading at 11 and a half times revenues. And so, with Tesla having reported last night, I thought what I would do is talk about Tesla. It's a company I don't really know. I haven't spent a lot of time with it. We've all watched the business grow incrementally here over the last handful of years. We've all marveled at this current $300 billion market cap. There's a sense in news, if you're paying attention, that the stock is now likely to be included by the wizards that run the committee at Standard & Poor's for inclusion into the S&P 500, that Tesla, because they've had 4 quarters of quote-unquote profitability, might be included. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of do what I did with Microsoft back in 2000 and look at what it would take in terms of growth in the underlying business to justify a $300 billion market cap today. I mean, here's an auto company. You've got to, Tesla. If you wanted to disrupt any industry, I think the last industry outside of maybe aircraft that you would disrupt, and airlines, would be automobiles. I mean, it's been just a lousy, lousy business for a long time. If you look at these stock charts for the last 20 years, they're all flat to down. The stocks trade at mid-single digit multiples to earnings. They don't earn their cost of capital over time. It's been a lousy business. And so, here's Tesla disrupting the business, trading at $300 billion on mid $20 billion in revenues, call it $26, $25 billion. revenues actually have declined over the last 2 years. They peaked third quarter of 2018. And it makes no sense to me. So, you know, you look out and ask yourself, and so the bulls would say, I suppose, that Tesla is not a car company, because why would you want to disrupt cars? It's software business. And so, you know, if you paint a scenario over, say, the next 20 years, you know, Tesla, they're thinking, you know, their goal is to do 500,000 cars this year. The total industry, you know, if US SAR was 17 million, maybe we're going to do 14 or 13 million cars this year globally. I don't know, maybe 80 million cars. You know, if you go back a couple of years, the total car industry, the manufacturers probably made 95 million cars. So, you know, round up and say 100 million cars are made globally. You know, and so, but if you assume Tesla would grow their units from 400,000 or 500,000 a year, all out of their plant in Fremont, California, they're building a plant in Shanghai, building a plant in Germany. You just saw the news; they're going to build their fourth plant in Austin, Texas. You know, if they can make 500,000 cars at the plant in Fremont, what's it going to take for this business to kind of scale into the current market cap? And so, if you look out 20 years and assume they can grow units to 20 million vehicles, which would be, you know, 20% of, you know, the current kind of peak run rate on global auto sales. Toyota does 10 million cars a year. Volkswagen does 10 million cars a year. GM does, I don't know, 6 or 7 million cars. They're a little bit larger than Ford. Assume Tesla can take 20% market share. What does it take to get there? Well, the software guys will tell you, you know, the holy grail is an installed base on a subscription model. And so, you know, I suppose the model when you buy a Tesla is you're going to get these software upgrades. And so if you assume they actually get to 20 million cars, they would have an installed base of, you know, maybe 5x that, you know, at some point, maybe 10x that, you know, of cars that were sold in prior years that are all being upgraded on software. So if you get to, you know, if you take, you know, an installed base of maybe 100 million cars, charge, you know, $100 a year, maybe $10 a month, $120 a year, you know, $120 a year on 100 million installed would get you to $12 billion. You know, if you put the fanciest of SaaS, Microsoft, Visa, MasterCard margins on the business and assume they have half profit, not going to pay any taxes probably because it's attached to a crappy car company that loses money, you know, $6 billion in revenues on 100 million cars. You know, they probably have a million and a half cars now in installed base. So you do the math on what, you know, $6 billion in profits, which is aggressive, looks like. At a 30 multiple, that's $180 billion. Well, the market cap of the company is already $180 billion. It makes no sense. So you think about the car business. Assume they take 20% market share. To get to $1 trillion in revenues, and that would be the 20 million cars at $50,000 a car. If they're going to grow to $1 trillion in revenues from today's $26 billion, let's not kid ourselves. I mean, at the end of the day, when I look at a business like Tesla, it's a car company, and they're going to have an installed manufacturing base. If they've got one plant now that can do 500,000 units, you know, it's going to take 40 plants. You look at the big car companies, you know, Toyota has 300 plus thousand employees. GM has a couple hundred thousand employees. These are very capital intensive businesses. And if you look at each of these car companies and the history of the car companies, to produce a dollar of revenue requires about a dollar of capital. And I don't think Tesla, if they're going to make cars, whether they sell them at a loss or not, to get to the subscription software business is another matter. But the capital requirement to grow the business sufficiently to justify, you know, not only the current market cap, but a future market cap which will allow for a return is insane. I mean, to do $1 trillion in revenues is going to take $1 trillion in capital or some number thereabout. Well, in the last, you know, the history of the business, I read the Q from March last night and I read the proxy this morning. And my history of reading Tesla's financial statements is limited to those two documents. So I really don't know the business that well. But the history of the business, that, you know, they've raised cumulative equity capital of $12 or $13 billion. Retained earnings are a -7, so they've lost $7 billion on the equity capital, and they've put debt in the business of about $18 billion. So, you know, pushing $30 billion in capital, lo and behold, you know, the business is doing mid-$20 billion in revenues. Ergo, a dollar of capital for a dollar of revenues, and I don't think you can escape that. So, if 20 years from now they actually grow to do 20 million cars, which would be 20% of current peak market share, it's going to take $1 trillion to do it. you play around with the numbers, and to get to a market cap of, you know, $1 trillion, let's say, which would be one-time sales, you know, that's about a 5% return. If you're going to get to a $2.5 trillion market cap, you earn 10% a year. So much future of everything going right is already baked into the stock. And if you want to make a really aggressive assumption and assume that, yeah, it is going to be a subscription, holy grail software business, and the car company is going to make money, kind of like a Toyota would, what are you going to make from a $300 billion market cap? For the record, I'm not short the stock, but, you know, I may have talked myself into the shorting the stock and looking at the stock last night, today. And then it's managed by, you know, a guy that some would consider, off. Let's just say off. So you read the proxy, and the compensation's out of control. The board gave Musk 20 million shares 2 years ago as compensation. Now they expensed, and they tell you not to expense it, but they expensed $2.5 billion. You know, he's been given 50 plus million shares, and so that's how you get to be the richest man in the world. Well, all of the hurdles, and you guys have probably seen this in the news today. One is they've got kind of this 12-point test on growing the market cap, and the market cap has to equal, you know, some certain number for, I think it's 6 months. And so at $300 billion, they've exceeded the $100 billion threshold now for the last 6 months. So his option shares start vesting. The performance hurdles that are tied to the option comp have nothing to do with return on capital, have nothing to do with profitability. They exclusively have to do with revenues and adjusted EBITDA. So again, if it's going to take $1 trillion in capital to grow to $1 trillion in revenues, on the car side of the business, debt finance the whole thing, or, you know, reinvest incremental profit, which I don't think exists, in that, you know, all of their profits come from, you know, earning emissions credits that are paid to them by other car companies. And that's a whole nother issue. And, you know, to meet these CAFE standards, you know, car companies that don't have a lot of battery powered cars have to, you know, are buying Tesla's surplus credits. And in the last quarter, if it was $400 million on, call it 100 million cars, that means each of their cars were subsidized to the tune of $4,000. That's insane. They also have deferred revenue for the software. And you guys might know how this works, but, you know, if they drop in software that makes the car fully automatic driving, they can incrementally pull revenue in that would be deferred at some level, I assume booked up front as revenues. So, you know, the accounting looks weird. I don't think this business is profitable, and the success of the business is wholly dependent, at least for the time being, on public policy. If they were not pulling in emissions credits and being paid those credits by GM and Fiat Chrysler, they would not have had a $100 million gap profit. They would have had a $300 million gap loss in the quarter, and they wouldn't be eligible for the S&P 500. I can end. I just think, you know, and again, Tesla may not be a great business. Microsoft was an absolutely outstanding business 20 years ago, and the stock was simply too expensive. Tesla is absurdly expensive on a current revenue base, assuming it's, you know, at least half a car company. And, you know, who knows, but, you know, to have the most aggressive assumptions over a 20-year horizon doesn't leave any upside as far as I'm concerned. I think it's a sucker's game to own the stock. And I think it's very reflective of a lot of these very high multiple, high price to sales businesses that when you look out over the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, fundamentally where everything is priced to go right, invariably it never does. And hence, ergo, I kind of get a sense that, you know, here in the last couple of weeks, we may have been seeing a peak not unlike the peak that we saw in March of 2000.
Chris, you might already know this, but this immediately made me think of Michael Mobison's base rate book, which you probably read, but if anyone hasn't, highly recommend it. And there was a version of it, it's been updated since. I don't know if it's still in there, but the one I'm looking at is from September of 2016, where he actually calls Tesla out as an example. And I actually didn't have any intention of wading into this debate. And I'm certainly not in the Elon Musk fanboy club, and I'm not in the Tesla Q haters club either, but I do find it stunning. I mean, this was almost 4 years ago, and off of an estimated sales base back in February of 15, Mobison's looking at it in September of 16 and saying that Elon Musk has said he's going to get 50% sales growth for the next per year for the next decade off a base of 6 billion. And that hasn't happened, obviously, and we're several years into that decade. but look at what the stock has done. And the interesting part of it too is that Mobison then went and found the proper, you know, inflation adjusted figures for basically every publicly traded company in the United States going back to, I believe, the 50s or 60s. So these were real companies, you know, starting off of a sales base of at least several billion, and how many of them compounded their sales growth over 45% for a decade. And it literally never happened. So it's not to say that it's impossible. It's just to say that it's not only unlikely, but it's literally unprecedented. And so here we are, right? It's pretty astounding.
I hadn't seen the book, and you know, it's just bizarre. Again, I haven't spent really much more than a nanosecond just kind of watching it and watching, you know, Elon in the news and a lot of his absurd behavior. But again, this has not been a great business. We're now disrupting what's not been a great business. I'm assuming that profitability via disruption can be done at a very high level and a very high rate. And I just don't get it.
I don't either. I'd be very curious for somebody to use the same sort of arguments you did, but in reverse, where they can actually lay out the numbers behind the bullishness rather than, this is sort of what I was getting at in my preamble, is I think it's more of a beauty contest where there's a high willingness in certain types of markets to just be in a liquid market like this, especially where, you know, you can sell it on at a higher price in a lot of cases. And that tends to prevail rather than kind of the numbers and the base rate and the things you were walking through. So unfortunately you're on the same side of the debate, I suppose, but it'd be great if somebody could, I don't know if Elliot wants to take that on, but argue the other side of it where you could make some sort of case that this would actually work out.
I'll take the trade desk angle on it. But first I want to like, thank you for bringing up the base rate book, because that's one of my permanent tabs I keep open in Chrome at all times.
Yeah.
Not just for quick reference, but to remind myself to be cognizant of base rates at all times and never get astray from that. If I had to explain what's happening in Tesla, I mean, obviously the product's awesome. I think what you really have is a very tight float. You have concentrated ownership with a founder who, you know, in each cap raise has proportionately maintained his share of ownership. You have a rabid fan base who is entirely agnostic and maybe, you know, unknowledgeable about valuation, who are owning the stock because it taps into a certain sense of community, and a couple strong institutional backers who have a lot of capital invested there that haven't had an inclination to sell yet, alongside a really large short interest that I think, if there's one thing I think the shorts to date have gotten most wrong, is not understanding the reflexivity of it all, whereby, you know, when they were talking about Tesla Q in the 200s, the problem is that if the stock started going up, even if the business didn't inflect, the likelihood of bankruptcy was getting taken off the table every day by Mr. Market handing the company currency. And so you have this tight float with these shorts who were just totally stuck, and no one willing to sell to them to cover, and a really crazy, you know, March, April, to now period of time. And I think that's when you get crazy things happening, like Volkswagen went parabolic during the with the Porsche and Volkswagen squeeze back in 2008. You know, it's exactly the kind of environment that lends itself to these cornered shareholder bases going parabolic. So, you know, my explanation would veer entirely from fundamentals and go completely into technicals and the mandate behind the people that own it.
I think this is one of those times, and I'm with you guys. I mean, price is the last thing you should think about. You know, I do all my work on the fundamentals of a business. I actually prefer, I host a roundtable here in St. Louis with 20, 25 really good value investors. And, you know, 10 or 12 of us pitch an idea each year. And, you know, a lot of times when I know what they're going to talk about, I do, the last thing I'll look at is the stock price. I want to go through and read the business, figure out what it does, figure out what I think it's worth, and then overlay with where the price is trading. I think this is one of those rare moments. And John, you talked about looking at the macro, and there are a lot of things in the economy that bother me, you know, quite a bit. But you look up and down this list of companies that are trading at very, very, very high valuations. Again, you know, the parallel being March 10 of 2000. And, you know, you take this list of what are, you know, in a lot of cases are going to wind up being really good businesses. Some are not going to be good businesses. AOL was a terrible business. They wound up with one of the most masterful jobs of capital allocation when Case sold the business to Time Warner. And, you know, Time Warner then sold AT&T, but AOL was going to go to zero. If you take these wonderful businesses like Shopify and Spotify and, you know, the whole NVIDIA, you know, good businesses in a lot of cases, Autodesk, wonderful business, but trading at 15 times sales. You know, Veritex trading at 15 times sales. Here's a case where if you happen to own these things, whether you're a passive investor or you've been in and made a lot of money, or you're just coming to the investment game and you're a Robin Hood trader, and you think you're going to jump into a party that's well underway, I would start with price. And, you know, under this Latin dictum of reducto ad absurdum, which I just did with Tesla and which, you know, I did with Microsoft 20 years ago, work backwards and take the current fundamentals, take the sales, take the cash flows, project out a realistic growth rate. I'm going to go read the Mimosin book. Project out growth rates. Try to figure out how much money this business is going to make, and can you justify A, the current price, but B, you know, what kind of valuation it's going to take to get you to a reasonable rate of return, to get you to, you know, bettering your opportunity cost, your cost of capital. How do I make 10% a year? How do I make 10% out a year out of Tesla, $300 billion? Not only does everything have to go right, I think it's an absolute impossibility. And unfortunately, some of these, you know, these wonderful businesses that exist today, you know, it's in the price and more. And so today would be a really good time to do what we were doing, you know, low those two decades ago, and figure out where you've got price that makes no sense. And, you know, in a lot of cases, if you happen to own those businesses or you're thinking about buying them, well, you better be careful. And there's where kind of the craft of kind of thinking long-term as a value investor really makes sense. I think a lot of people are going to get burned really, really badly prospectively from today's valuations, at least in those corners of the markets.
Well, this reminds me too of the Scott McNeely comment, and Chris, you probably remember this one, when he was at Sun Microsystems in the peak of the late 90s into the early 2000s, and the stock went from like 5 to 65 or something like that. And he looked back after it had come back round tripped all the way to 5, and he said, you know, we kind of did everything right. We did what we said we were going to do, but we were trading at 10 times revenues. And it's just kind of a crazy starting price for most businesses. And so that's obviously great and true in hindsight, but I would be curious. I mean, so Tesla is a tough one because it's such a different animal, both in terms of the business and the, you know, the industry it's in and the leadership it has. But what about Trade Desk or something like that, where it's a much more, where it's a legitimately good business and, you know, has a different set of leadership and outlook for it? I mean, what do you think the prognosis?
As someone who is involved with Trade Desk and kind of blew it and bought at a great price and sold a little too early, I mean, and I never sized up, I do see a fundamental problem with them that I was never able to get over. And I still can't. They boast these extraordinary EBITDA margins, but they have no cash flow to show for it. And the problem is that the receivables and payables are on gross levels of ad spend that goes through the platform, not the net levels of, you know, revenue and COGS. And so as they grow, they have to invest tremendous amounts of money into working capital. And then what happens is if they, you know, when they inevitably exit this hyper growth phase and slow down to a more steady state, if their take rate compresses, which might happen, then they again will have to eat up all their cash flow and working capital investment. So I have a hard time with something like Trade Desk, and it's bizarre to me as a I bought it similar timing in Roku, but I have decently more Roku these days. No Trade Desk, so obviously decently more Roku. But Trade Desk is soaring on their potential in CTV, and Roku's, you know, it's doing well, all things considered, but it's not really getting the same love, and their kind of bread and butter, their wheelhouse is CTV advertising. So I kind of just don't understand it. And the interesting thing with Roku, I'd say, is they are, the last 2 years, they have tried and aimed for a 0% EBITDA margin and ended up, if you look at EBITDA to platform revenues, in the mid to upper single digits. So they have like the ability to actually generate cash flow. They just choose not to. So I think it's a little different. It's kind of weird. But long story short, I don't quite get it with Trade Desk. I don't quite get the runaway enthusiasm there. More high level, like one of the things I think about a lot here is that the market's kind of bracketed into two buckets, like the winners and the losers from this new normal or new environment. And, from 2010 to 2019, there wasn't really much dispersion in the market. So there are obviously some stocks that stood out, but by and large, the correlations between every decile of performance in the S&P were pretty tight. So, everything moved together the same way at the same times. But that's really changed lately. So like you have this big group of winners and this big group of losers, and it's bifurcated into two classes of the market. But I kind of think from here, there's going to be this further narrowing within the two groups. So within the winners group, you're going to have a realization that certain one stocks that are being treated as winners today are actually experiencing more ephemeral bumps in their revenue base that won't lead to like a higher plateau that they could grow off of, while there's a better set of winners that are actually experiencing a meaningful, step change in their utility to customers that'll be a higher plateau that they could continue to grow off of. And then on the loser side, there are going to be some businesses who are permanently impaired and they're gone for good, but there are going to be some that are really, temporarily impaired due to the environment that'll experience some normalization. So like I'm expecting like further dispersion within this bifurcation. And I think that's part of what like the market's not piecing through right now. There just hasn't been incrementally new information since this happened. So momentum's running away in each category of winner and loser.
Which is the same thing you saw in the late 90s. I mean, for the better part of the last 10 years, you can even take these top five big, quote unquote tech companies, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook. And that group, collectively and individually, generally were not expensive. You can make the case, you take the cash out of Google, for example, and it was spent the better part of the last 10 years undervalued. And the returns you earned as a shareholder kind of correlated with the growth of the businesses. Well, here you are 10 years on, and incrementally, COVID aside, which has helped some, hurt some, you're seeing growth rates slow down. None of these five businesses were still growing at 20% a year at the end of the year. The growth curves are slowing, but you're seeing this now exponential move up in the share prices. And they're all trading at 30 plus to earnings. You've got to do some normalization, of course, with Amazon for their AWS business and what that business looks like 5-10 years out. And it's a lot more profitable on a net income basis. But you take those five and the expansions now where the market values have grown that much faster than revenues and cash flows and profits, and expand that to this next group of the SaaS businesses. And a lot of these businesses that are really good businesses that have just seen the stock prices grow by factors of underlying revenues and even theoretical revenue growth. And that's where you start to get dangerous. And that's where in the last couple of months, really coming, 3 months, let's say, well after the March 23 lows, you've had this enormous bifurcation. And you have businesses that are genuinely harmed by the virus and by the economic slowdown. Some, overly harmed, I think, in the case of, property casualty insurance, reinsurance. There are a lot of things going on under the hood with price increases where, that group has been, unduly punished. But again, kind of back to my original thesis and looking at kind of this higher end of these businesses that, stocks that are trading at north of 10 times sales, that group on the Bloomberg calculation was up 55% for the year as of last night's close. And you look underneath the surface at the underlying growth of those businesses, and it is not 55%. So you've had this bifurcation again in the market, but you've also had this flood of incremental capital, new capital coming into the markets. And in some cases where you don't have a lot of float underneath, you mentioned the Tesla float, insiders own 25% of the company. It's not taking as much money to push up share prices. The other thing you're seeing is kind of largely across the board, volumes are beginning to taper off. And the same thing happened in early 2000. volumes of the high flyers and really volumes into the market started declining. And you're starting to see a lot of the same thing again. So I'm, you know, I would encourage anybody that's heavily invested in, you know, any of this group of companies that are trading at north of 10 to revenues, which always has been a red flag for us. I mean, you know, it's just everything has to go right on the growth front to grow into valuations when you get that stretched, both in terms of margins and in terms of multiples. And, you know, we're really stretched on multiples, you know, in some cases not on margins, in some cases you are on margins. You know, a number of these businesses won't be as profitable 5 and 10 years from now as they are today. Some of these businesses will fail. Some will be disrupted. You'll have obsolescence, and you're going to have a handful of winners and losers. And I just think collectively at the top of this, you know, multiple to sales of 10x and above, you know, buyer beware in today's market.
Well, Chris, I'm glad you mentioned the parallels between 2000 and 2020, because I didn't internalize until just recently how many investors today were not actually around in 1999 and 2000. You know, I think to you and I guess that makes us old, it's so obvious the parallels. And you, what was striking to me, you said it feels like that, and it really does. You know, when you have Shopify at like 60 or 70 times sales, and then Nikola come out with like a drawing of a truck.
Yeah, don't know revenues, right?
Yeah, and the FOMO is off the charts, you know, and here we are resisting like good little choir boys while everyone's having a party. And then you realize that actually a lot of the folks who are paying these prices just weren't around in 2000, and they're repeating something that they don't even really know about.
Yeah, I think conventional wisdom for those that didn't live it is that the difference between today and then was there were so many businesses that that didn't generate profits, and in some cases even sales. You know, you were IPOing businesses that were business plans, and you're seeing some of that today. And so the NASDAQ traded at 240 times earnings at the peak in March 2000. But again, that 242 times was not on the backs of Microsoft's 38% profit margin, but it was on the backs of a lot of businesses that commanded very high market caps that had no profit, you know, that were burning money. And actually, if you threw the losses into the mix, that's how you got to 242 times. But as you go through this list that I ran last night of the 522 companies trading at more than 10 times sales, there were 227 of those with market caps above $1 billion. So you've got, you know, another 300 businesses with market caps below $1 billion. And as you get into the smaller businesses, you see biotech company after biotech company after biotech, even medical equipment company after medical equipment, you know, software as a service company after software as a service. There are a whole bunch of businesses that have no revenues and no profits that are public companies that, you know, are all call options. And, you know, you can go through them one by one and do your fundamental analysis, but I haven't seen that much excess in terms of that many businesses trading at very substantial market values. And I never thought I'd see it again. You know, I never believed you'd see the bifurcation, you'd see the excesses that we saw. You'd assume that investors learned their lessons. And turns out, you know, financial history repeats itself. It's always in a different shade, but.
Well, there's one big difference though. And I think it's, I was introduced to this book by Modest Proposal from Twitter called Effed Companies, based on a website that had the more colorful name of that, with the subtitle Spectacular.com Flameouts by Philip Kaplan. And it was written like as the dot-com bubble was coming down. And it's basically like a 1 to 2 page summary of every one of these ideas presented as just absolutely absurd. And, you know, it included the obvious ones like pets.com and CMGI and everything else that you could name under the sun from that era. And some that I just like had no recall of, one other being Cosmo.com. But it, you know, gives a basic intro to these business models or ideas really and shreds them apart. But one of the interesting things is the companies that are actually working today, like there are a lot of these business models ended up working when they finally had the chance and they were developed well. And people were a little more comfortable using the internet for commerce. So eventually these terrible ideas were not so terrible. The biggest distinction though that I feel is that valuations have gotten a little out of hand. So the businesses back then weren't proven out, had no clear path to be viable anytime in the near future, didn't have a cost structure that was built to bridge the path from idea to, you know, actual business. Today, those elements, Tesla's slightly different because they do rely on capital markets for financing. But aside for them, most of these companies are internally financed. They're funding their growth with, at the very least, revenues. So that's pretty different. That said, you know, when Shopify was at 40 times sales, I love joking that the path from 40 times sales to a 40x PE is an ugly one. And so I think it's even more true, you know, at 60 to 70 times sales, because one day this business is going to be a 40 times PE business. And, you know, it probably means the stock goes sideways for a very, very long time with at least some sort of meaningful drawdown.
Yeah. The other argument you see today, you know, cast pretty widely is the obvious notion, and to a degree it's correct, is that interest rates are a hell of a lot different today than they were 20 years ago.
Right.
You've got a 60 basis point 10-year. But you see a lot of valuation justifications being made on a 10-year at 60 basis points. And you use the Fed model under a 1% interest rate, you should pay 100 times earnings. At a 0.5% interest rate, you should pay 200 times. At some level, it becomes absurd. You go back to the Japanese case, which has had no growth in nominal GDP for the last 30 years. That market traded at 80 times earnings 30 years ago, and given the lack of growth, and there have been businesses that have grown in Japan, pharmaceutical companies, the cosmetic businesses, but, you know, in aggregate, you've had no growth in that economy. And despite progressively lower interest rates, and interest rates that have been zero for a very long time and even negative, all you've had is multiple compression. And I think in today's world, you know, the fact that we have the short-term interest rate set at 0.25% by the Fed, and you know, likely to be held there for a very long time, not to mention, you know, perhaps the Fed pushing them along into the curve. We're going to have low rates for a long time, but they're there because there's not a lot of growth. And I wrote in my letter last year when I was talking about the big five tech stocks that had grown at 19-20% a year for a decade. That happened in a climate where the overall S&P 500's revenues grew by 3.5% a year. I don't think a lot of investors would grasp that you had that little growth. And I don't see how you're going to get any more growth in that perspectively. And so you kind of have the haves and the have-nots. And I think you're exactly right. You know, you do have businesses that really don't require capital. And to the extent they do, they can internally finance it. And so you should have the haves and have-nots. But again, you start to get to the Shopify type numbers at 60 to sales, and you better start thinking a hell of a lot more about what can go wrong versus what can go right, because, you know, price becomes, you know, the single reference point that you ought to be focused on at that point.
I mean, imagine if the 30-year treasury was at 5%, what would that do to the multiples of these companies, you know? And yeah, it's at 1% and change, but would any of us today lock up our money at 1% nominal for 30 years, given what the Fed is doing with its balance sheet? So, you know, the Fed model is probably the only model that's showing the market as reasonable. Any other model is screaming danger. You know, you take Tobin's Q, you take market cap to GDP, any of those, it's not the signal is not a good one.